Difficult topic too to discuss and comfortable with. However, I would like just to also kind of revisit that the delusion that a fish has in not recognizing absolute reality is exactly the same type. We have the same ignorance, and to see that this type of ignorance pervades all beings in all realms of existence. It's the same ignorance. It's the ignorance that does not perceive absolute truth. And so, in the same way that our pet dogs don't perceive absolute truth, in that same way we don't. And the reason for that is that absolute truth does not appear from its own side. Absolute truth is a phenomenon that's called a subtle hidden phenomenon, and it's also called a non-affirming negation, which means that maybe something that gives insight into this is a quote from a text by Maitreya Buddha, and the text is called Knowing Things in the Nature of Things, or Dharma Dharmata Vibhanga Karika. Dharma means things, phenomena. Dharmata means the nature of things. Thank you. And Vibhanga means to discern or to distinguish. like the Sanskrit word vibhanga and our word division, that the vi means to separate. Now, something I find kind of interesting is, in fact, that, you know, that the Indo-European mother tongue that preceded Latin and Greek became also Sanskrit. And so there are certain words that we, like our word heart, and the seed syllable for Avalokiteshvara is Hri. It's interesting. From the same Indo-European mother tongue. Also, for example, in Latin, the word mens mentis for mind. Mentes, that root, mens mentes, and mantra is the same word. It's from Sanskrit. The Sanskrit word mantra is, in fact, the evolving from the same Indo-European mother tongue as the word, our word, mind. So, I mean, it took a while, but we can still see that those traces remain in our language. Hmm. So we wouldn't normally think that Sanskrit and English have anything in common, but in fact, English being one of the languages that evolved from the Central Indo-European mother tongue does have characteristic qualities also in Sanskrit. The Sanskrit word aloke for light, electricity, and electric, same word. So anyway, don't want to get too far off, but the deal is that this vibhanga means to discern or to distinguish things, dharma, or appearances. Maitreya Buddha also calls appearances nangwa, which means kind of like luminosity, and that appearance is also linked with light, and so that all color and shape that we perceive, all form that we perceive, is in fact luminous, and that it's interesting also that the element ether is the medium for light. So in any case, dhamma dhammata vibhanga karika, vibhanga means to distinguish, to be able to discern a phenomenon from the nature of the phenomenon. Now, when we see this, like if we look at this mala here, we call it a mala. Means that, you know, we're going to say, okay, this has the self, or there's something intrinsically mala about this. It's like it appears to us to be an entity that is not depending upon causes and conditions. It appears to exist from its own side. Is that there's something here that's a mala. Okay. Now, what is really important from this text's point of view, the quote that I was originally referring to, is that Maitreya Buddha says in this text, appearance itself is wrong. Perception is mistaken. If we perceive it, it's wrong. Because simply by virtue of its appearance, that perception itself is in fact confused. This is interesting, and this lines up with what we were talking about last night and the night before, when we were defining ignorance, and which is the main problem, the root of the problem. Ignorance is being actually instinct. You know, and that this ignorance is pervasive of all living beings. You know, and that in essence, then when Maitreya Buddha explains, perception itself is mistaken because it does not perceive non-duality, or it does not perceive absolute truth. Perception, because when we perceive, it's automatically dualistic. It automatically defines our experience by subject and object, and because it automatically does that, it's mistaken. Does that make sense? It's like when we see, when we perceive, we're already wrong. At the instant, simultaneously with perception, there's a mistake already. And so when we think about the Four Noble Truths and how profound they are, this is the impediment that is uprooted or broken up by cultivating absolute wisdom. And so, in essence, when we're talking about a resolution to suffering and the cause of suffering, we're actually talking about transcending instinct. It means going one step past nature. That's why it would be called transcendent. Because throughout the infinite flow, or throughout the flow, or the timeless flow of infinite time and space, meaning the ebb and flow of all phenomena arising and passing away, in the timeless and boundless, the infinite matrix of infinite space, that this life force that causes living beings to come into and out of existence, when causes and conditions change, then life forms become extinct. When causes and conditions are conducive, life forms appear. And so life forms coming into and out of existence are driven by delusion, by this ignorance that does not perceive absolute truth. And therefore they're at the mercy of their delusion and karma. And so what the Four Noble Truths is getting at is using this particular opportunity that this very fragile, delicate, temporal or transient body-mind composition affords us is an intellect that has the ability to penetrate into the discrepancy between appearance and the nature of appearance, and by that become free from this instinctive delusion that drives life. So when we're talking about the wheel of life, it really, this Svabhava chakra means that. And we shouldn't think that it's talking about something else other than existence, because that's what it is talking about. Existence. You know, universal existence. Or, being a universal living being, abiding in the one of the realms of universal existence. Now, why it's maybe more accessible to us to not use a hell being or a hungry ghost or a long life god or a titan, like the Greek gods, would be kind of like titans, is because we can all kind of, we have animals share our same kind of biosphere somehow. But as I said last night, the quarry pond for a fish is not a quarry pond. Yes, that's that fish's whole matrix for existence. The pond. You waiting for getting a chair? Yeah, good. Okay, thank you. thank you. So that fish, for example. So we see the fish. We are sharing this same biosphere, except that the pond for the fish is completely different than we perceive it. We perceive it as a pond. The fish doesn't perceive it that way. Now, neither of us perceive the absolute true nature of whatever we're perceiving. And that ignorance is the same for the fish as it is for me. I got a little, kind of far afield with the fish last night, but the reason is I wanted to make the point that the absolute true nature, the ignorance that blocks my dog, I don't have a dog, but when I had a dog, the dogs that I've had, from seeing absolute true nature, is the same ignorance that I have that blocks me from seeing absolute true nature. And perception or appearance, as Maitreya Buddha says, it's appearance itself that's wrong. It's mistaken. Because it does not, absolute truth of appearance does not appear from its own side. That requires the cultivation or the attainment. We'll talk about it tonight, the path of achievement. It means to achieve absolute wisdom. So it means using this opportunity to cultivate or to realize a transcendent experience that in fact is really the truth. It's like from the viewpoint of the Four Noble Truths, all life forms in samsara, all universal life forms, do not see the truth. So, and also all human beings that are not Aryas do not see the truth either. Now, it's all right there in front of us. It's not that it's inaccessible or difficult to get at. It's not. It's right there. The problem is that we need to train ourselves to recognize what is already there. We need to awaken within us a knowledge that is the seed or the latent. It's like latent knowledge, latent awareness. It's kind of a gestalt, I guess, the thing. You know, gestalt means like, I guess, the teacher doesn't give knowledge to anybody. Knowledge doesn't go from the teacher to the student. It's rather what the function of the teacher is to awaken in the student latent knowledge. So it's kind of like that, you know, with the awakening to absolute truth. It's not that we take absolute truth as a something that exists outside from us and integrate it into our stream of being. Rather, it's by through the force of familiarity and consistency and concentration, we in fact recognize what is in front of us with such vivid clarity that it becomes transformative. And you know, the thing about Buddha Dharma that's so beautiful is that it in fact, it does say it's right there. Like we all know Grand Canyon, right? It's a big thing. It's a big national monument. You know, 2 million people go there a year. Look at Grand Canyon. But Grand Canyon itself is just a very big advertisement for absolute truth. It's like going, you know, and you see this little river down in the bottom. You know, it's not little at all. It's little, but it's like, and over the millions of years, it just washed all that away. And it kind of started like a little trickle somewhere. And up on the mesa tops around there, you can see, oh, this used to be the bottom of an ocean. And then something gave away and the ocean kind of drained out, and the Colorado River is kind of like the dregs, what's left over. And so it's like we all know about Grand Canyon, but we don't see the true nature of Grand Canyon. Unless we choose to say, man, this is a really loud teaching on absolute truth. That everything that I perceive, in fact, is illusory. Now, so when we think about that more and more and more, then the implications of the illusory transitory nature of phenomena begins to sink in and take root deeply within us, and then that becomes very transformative. We become, and why it's transformative and why it gives peace, which is one of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, which we'll talk about tonight, why it gives peace is we pull ourselves into alignment with reality. And though not speaking from experience, it would be as though the person meditates and meditates and meditates and strives and really, oh, I have to attain the path of seeing. I have to have direct insight into the nature, the empty nature of universal phenomena. And finally, you know, the breakthrough happens and there's a transformative experience and the entire universe kind of goes like, well, you know, it's about time. You know, I've always been like this and you've been on a trip someplace. It's like, you know, you're very lucky. You know, that you finally woke up, but it's been a while. Meanwhile, this is the way it's always been. It's never been different than this. And that's, you know, that's why it becomes like a, well, it's referred to the ancient ones, because it's timeless. You know, those who realize that in mystical texts, you say in the hall of the ancients, means that, you know, that this particular nature of existence has never been anything other than this. Okay, so All right, so we'll talk about the 12-link chain of interdependent origination briefly. In the 12-link chain, let's see, did we finish? Okay, delusion. Okay, now last night we did. Okay, delusion. Okay, the delusions five that are not views. Ignorance, instinctive. This instinctive ignorance, attachment, craving, attachment, aversion, pride, and doubt. Not jealousy. Often jealousy is one of the five, but it's not a delusion. When we talk about these five with jealousy, that means the five poisons or five conflicting emotions. So in this case, five delusions. Doubt. Doubt means like, I'm not sure, and therefore we leave ourselves open for another delusion such as attachment to wend its way into our decision, and we make the wrong decision. And so that's meaning doubt. It's like, oh, I'm not sure. Like, for example, if we talk about the 10, what are called 10 immoral or unethical behaviors of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, harsh speech, slander and gossip, and malice, and craving attachment, delusion. Three of the mind, four of the speech, and three of the body. Well, I'm not really sure that that those bring are the by acting in accordance with those 10 kind of guideposts. I'm not sure that acting in accordance with them is actually the cause of happiness. Will actually bring happiness to me. You know, I mean, I'm not sure that if I steal this that I'm gonna, you know, create bad karma by that. I mean, it's kind of having doubt about something like that, which leaves us open for another factor to enter the picture and make and help us create negative karma. And that's why doubt is the fifth delusion. Now, the sixth one is the delusion that our views are means views. If they're views, means intellectually acquired. They don't mean like instinctive, like, you know, just ignorance and a want and aversion. The ones that are views are ones that we kind of like sit down and figure out and draw the wrong conclusion, based generally upon ignorance. And attachment. Remember those five. Let's see if I remember those five. Okay, the wrong view of the aggregates. You know, the aggregates are truly existing. The body-mind composition is truly existing. And there's a real self that does possess it. We talked about that last night. If we asked 250 million Americans if they truly existed, they'd say damn straight. So, and why? Because, you know, they would believe, okay, well, you know, I know myself, I feel, I think. You know, what is that? Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Like that. So, the wrong view of the aggregates. Intellectually acquired. The wrong view of the extremes, which means the past and the future, the extreme past and the extreme future. The extreme past is there's no previous lives. That's a delusion. It's intellectually acquired. There's no previous life because it's not my experience. No one ever came back from a previous life and talked about it. Because if they came back from a previous life, it wouldn't be a previous life because it's now. Previous life is gone. So they can't come back and talk about it. If they come back and talk about a previous life, it wasn't a previous life. It's a hallucination of theirs because there is no previous life. There's only this life. So then thinking that there's no continuum or continuity of consciousness from the past life that actually became the catalyst for this life. Meaning, remember we talked last night about the throwing or propelling and the completing karma of this life. That this life, the completing karma, the throwing karma that resulted in a human rebirth, and the completing karma, which means our family of origin and the situation that we happen to find ourselves in, as well as the continuously evolving conditions around us that actually, in fact, will eventually bring our demise. The completing karma is like how we, the specific way in which we die is a completing karma. That's why it's called a completing karma, is it resolves. It's the conditions that resolve or dissolve, I guess, this existence, this particular one. So I'm not believing that this existence is the result of the throwing and completing karma of a previous existence. This is an intellectually acquired delusion from the Buddhist perspective. Okay, then just as this existence is not the result of the throwing and completing karma of the previous existence, this existence isn't. Therefore, this existence is not the condition whereby the throwing and completing karma of the next incarnation is existent. In other words, this life is not the ground for where the throwing and completing karma for the next life is created. So in other words, denying the existence of the future life as well. That's why it's called the extreme view of the past and the future, is not believing in past and future lives. And okay, now before we go on, I think it's important to just take a second to define more precisely what is meant by reincarnation from the Buddhist perspective. You know, Stephen Batchelor, a friend of mine, wrote a book recently. I don't remember the name of it, but it's a thin little book published by the Tricycle. Huh? Yeah. And his premise is, well, it's just like, you know, kind of toss out, reincarnation and karma. And hey, it's all good then. It's a bestseller. Now that's fine, I'm very happy with that, except for the fact that if you toss out reincarnation and karma, you in essence make it non-Buddhism. So Buddhism without those particular beliefs isn't Buddhism, so there's an internal contradiction that I would like to debate with him someday. He's a friend of mine, but to say Buddhism without beliefs, and the two beliefs that he wants to divest Buddhism of in this particular book, doesn't mean it's an invalid book. But it's strange to call it Buddhism without those particular beliefs, because then it's not Buddhism at all. Now, that does not mean that Buddhism doesn't have a tremendous contribution to make to the field of mental health and emotional stability and family functionality. It does, simply based upon its psychology. But to ignore the fact that Buddhism explains how we got here and where we're going to go if we don't, like, take, you know, the moment in hand and do something, you know, constructive with it. And that is a very important part of what Buddhism has to offer living, universal living beings. And so it's a delusion to not believe in the past and future lives from the Buddhist perspective. It's a fundamentally important part of Buddha Dharma to know that the primary cause for this existence was already created prior to the semen and egg coming together. That is not the primary existence for the primary cause of me. It's not the copulation of my parents. The primary cause for the self was my karma that I created. Okay, so anyway, I was very, really very young when I first heard these kind of teachings, and I couldn't get it. Was trying to like put a square block through a round hole. I could not get the fact that I am the primary cause for my existence is within me. Fortunately, I've noticed that most people that I've come into contact with over the last 20 years don't have that big of that hard of a time as I had with it. I had a pretty hard time trying to get comfortable with the concept that the primary cause for my existence was not kind of a random occurrence of my parents meeting. that in fact I had really a lot to do with it somehow, you know. Now, what the trick is, and it's a trick or the important bit of knowledge to have about reincarnation is that if in the previous existence, you know, I was some kind of like yak, you know, the bell like this, and I was called whatever, you know, that yak herd are called, you know, that person. Maybe called me Dorje Jigje. But so if I was a yak named Dorje Jigje in the last life, you see, you can't, it's like saying Buddhism without beliefs. I was a yak. That's wrong. Because this life I'm Alan Chittock or Chris Kolb or whatever. So the self of this life is not the same self as is a previous life. It's a different. So to say I was, we always think that way. And it's like when I was a hippie traveling around Europe and the Middle East and Afghanistan, is I met like Genghis Khan a few times, I met Cleopatra a few times, I met Nefertiti a few times. Because, you know, people is like, well, you know, I got some kind of past life reading or some kind of vision tripping on acid. Like, I know who I was in my previous life. And so the thing is that we, you know, when we think about reincarnation, we immediately put it in the frame of reference that we experience the self in this life and sort of think that I am the same this life as I was in a previous life. And that's wrong. You know, if I was a yak named Dorje Jigje in the last life, if the continuum or the predecessor of this body-mind composition was a yak named Dorje Jigje in the previous lifetime, you know, you could call it Nalan Chittock or Chris Kolb until hell froze over and it didn't apply. If you call me Dorje Jigje in this life, I'm probably not going to turn around. You know, and so the self of this life is not the same self as a previous life. But it's important to know that there's a continuum of existence or a continuum or a stream of being that transmigrates from life to life. And that thing itself is empty of true existence. That's important. That continuum or that indestructible stream of being is in fact the ground, what they call nature body. It's in fact, it is that itself that is Buddha nature. That indestructible stream of being or pure energy is Buddha nature. It has no beginning. It is not subject to destruction. It's like life itself. Now another thing that Maitreya Buddha says that is very interesting in the Uttara Tantra is that Buddha nature's deluded approach to existence is through seeking happiness through worldly things. That's profound. That the approach of Buddha nature, Buddha nature takes three approaches to existence. Either deluded or mixed or pure. The deluded approach that Buddha nature, which it sounds like a contradiction, but it's important to know. The quest for happiness itself is going to produce enlightenment sooner or later. Because after we've circled in samsara since enough time, eventually life itself, Buddha nature will find the cause for true happiness. For example, the function of Buddha nature is to disillusion the sentient being from wrong paths. Which means the function of Buddha nature is to say, look, you've already had, you know, relationships that you thought were going to make you happy and that didn't work. You've already had material that you thought would make you happy and that didn't work. You've already had all this stuff and it's never worked before. So true happiness or true peace of mind has to be found somewhere else. And so beginning to get disillusioned with the power or the illusion of power that material phenomena have to deliver happiness. It can't deliver happiness. Happiness is something that comes from within us and it's a dependence arising like everything else. The cause has to be created. And so this wisdom is that through practicing you know, ethics and concentration, you know, meditation, and acquiring constant a focus of mind that actually penetrates the veil of duality, that this becomes a means by which a wisdom dawns within us that delivers us from the wheel of conditioned existence. Or it's called Sipe Korlo, means the wheel of misery, birth and death. And so this is really, I think it's profound, and the thing is why we can call it spiritual, even though it's psychologically valid and it's based upon reality, we can call it spiritual because it's just so incredibly awesome. You know, that by recognizing things as they truly exist, as they are naturally, that this becomes the agent for transcendence. By seeing reality, we transcend samsara. Anyway. So. So this, okay, not seeing this, that this causes us to create karma out of the out of the delusion of the believes in the inherent or true existence of the self, causes us to create this karma that that is either done out of attachment for happiness or out of aversion or wanting to avoid unhappiness. And last night, then, I also expressed that, in fact, we're equally invested in having enemies as we are friends. That the enemy kind of validates our perception of who we are as much as our friends do. And that those two things are interchangeable. Like the friend is a friend as long as they agree with us, and then when they don't agree with us, then they become the enemy. And so, you know, we're invested in having enemies as much as we are in having friends. If we have the notion of a truly existing self that is inherently truly exists with inherent qualities. The 12-link chain of interdependent origination, then, what it is, ignorance that doesn't see reality. Because of that, we create karmic formations, which gives rise to our consciousness, how we think about things, you know, our specific consciousness, name and form. The form is the form aggregate, and name are the four mental aggregates: feeling, discrimination, karmic formations or compounded phenomena, or impulse, consciousness. Name and form, and then the sixth sense dhatu means like spheres. So, like the eye sense sphere is the organ of the eye, the consciousness that the eye is the aperture or the door, and the object of the eye. So those three things. So we say 18 dhatus, we think, oh no, this is getting really complicated. It's really pretty simple, that what happens is that we have six senses, each with three, or each has one organ, one and one object of the organ. The sense power. It's like the when they say, for example, in the text, the philosophical text, it goes, Wang Po Nga. Wang Po means power. So Nga means the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. And so, okay, the eye organ needs to have the power of the sense. The organ itself isn't sufficient. It has to work, in other words. It has to be a functioning organ. Okay. And so the eye sense consciousness, the eye organ, enlivened with or energized by the power of the sense, and the object, color and shape. So color and shape is the object. The empowered organ is the empowered organ, and then the consciousness that perceives it. So the eye sense realm means those three things: and the consciousness, the agent, and the object. And so it's the same with ear, nose, tongue, the body and the mind. Okay, what's the organ of the mind is the brain. Consciousness. The organ of the consciousness is the brain. The object of consciousness is thought. Conceptual thought. And so this is kind of important too, that that conceptual thought, that the brain, that the brain is the organ of ordinary conceptual thoughts, ideas, and notions. Okay, so the sixth sense fields is the fifth. Link, and then contact, which means the senses coming into contact with their objects, and that gives rise to feeling, which is the seventh one, and feeling gives rise to craving for more, wanting it, the pleasing things more, and then when craving becomes more developed, it becomes grasping. So craving is kind of like a yearning or a longing for, and grasping becomes kind of like obsessed. It's like when longing for becomes an obsession. So it's the same, they're very similar, but one is like a further development. So when we hear craving and grasping in the wheel of conditioned existence, the eighth and ninth links, craving means like longing or wanting, thirsting for, and then grasping becomes almost a compulsive or an obsessive investment. It's like the perfection of grasping. Okay, craving, grasping, or I'm craving. Craving, grasping, and then becoming means existing. You know, the becoming means, in fact, existence itself or being. And out of the thirst for being then comes birth, or in this case, rebirth, and from rebirth comes death. And so then, for example, going backwards, it's interesting that death, you know, that the cause of death is getting born. The cause of being born is becoming. The cause of becoming is grasping. The cause of grasping is craving. The cause of craving is feeling, pleasant things, feeling. You know, good, bad, and indifferent feelings, grasping or craving to experience pleasurable things and to avoid unpleasant things. Okay, then the cause of craving is the contact, that the sense organs coming into contact with the object, and the cause of contact is the six sense organs themselves, and the cause of the six sense organs is name and form, and the cause of name and form is the consciousness, and the cause of consciousness, the way we think, who we are, the specific viewpoint of our consciousness is dependent upon karmic formations, and karmic formations are founded upon ignorance, actions done out of attachment or aversion or delusion. And then, as we said last night, another way to look at this is through the causes that were the agents for the propelling and propelling karma of the previous life were ignorance, karmic formations, consciousness, craving, grasping, and becoming. Those six were the agent from the prior existence, and then in this existence, name and form, which was what? Simultaneous. When does name and form occur? Conception. When the semen and egg and the consciousness principle all create the germinal being. And then as it develops further, then it the name and form becomes the six sense organs, or the six sense fields, which become then beget contact. Contact begets feeling. And so in terms of the developing fetus, feeling is when the fetus develops the ability to know hot from cold, to know pleasant from unpleasant, safety, from feeling secure, from feeling afraid. And so, and then birth. And we know birth. And so, according to the doctrine of the chain of interdependent origination, we've already completed 11 and a half of them. The only thing that's left now is to die. But the other links have already been completed. And these 12 links are what holds the Svabhava Chakra, or the wheel of conditioned existence, together. Okay, so and then, okay, now the four attributes of suffering. I'm not going to spend time on that right now, because tonight we are going to talk about the 16 attributes. Okay, and so this is actually, you will find that tonight we're going to finish exactly on time, and you'll see that all this discussion before, in fact, set this, you know, put everything in perspective. It's all going to make, it will all hang together really perfectly in result to the, or in res, as a result of all of the kind of the meticulous, and precise kind of like tearing down of the components of the four, what goes into the four truths of the Aryas, specifically suffering and the cause of suffering. When we get clear about suffering and the cause of suffering, cessation and the producer, the path to cessation follows very logically. Okay, so now the four attributes of suffering. Okay, so what the four attributes of suffering? Okay, the four attributes of suffering. Suffering here refers to what? The first of the four truths of the Aryas. Okay, and so all phenomena are impermanent. Okay, all compounded phenomena, meaning in this case the aggregates, meaning here are the aggregates, are suffering. Okay, and we talked so much about that, pervasive suffering of change, pervasive suffering. Okay, now the third thing, emptiness. Okay, and the fourth thing, selflessness. Now, what is that? Okay, so we already know about everything being transient. We're okay with that. We already know that compounded phenomena are contaminated phenomena, not compounded, contaminated phenomena are suffering. Contaminated by what? Ignorance, yeah. Delusion? Right, ignorance, delusion. Ignorance and delusion. Ignorance is the one that doesn't perceive the reality. And that's the root cause. The ignorance that does not see absolute truth. That is the root cause of samsara. Okay, so all contaminated phenomena are suffering. In the nature of suffering. And so from that perspective, a deluded being looking at the universe is in fact suffering. The conditions, the environment is suffering. So all contaminated phenomena are suffering. And then, emptiness. Okay, emptiness in this case refers to the five aggregates being empty. Okay, now emptiness and selfless, these two we can equate with I and mine. Selflessness negates the I, and emptiness negates, or is the selflessness is the nature of the true nature of the I, and emptiness is the true nature of the aggregates. Okay, so the aggregates is like the I is not found in the body anywhere. The I is not found in any of the aggregates. So all of these aggregates are empty of the self. But still, there's the I, the concept of I that possesses the five aggregates. And that does not exist as it appears. So when we see, what's the difference between emptiness and selflessness in these four? The difference is that the five aggregates, singly or in any combination or accumulatively or collectively, the I is not found in the five aggregates. So the five aggregates are empty of the I. And yet there's still this perceived or conceived object, the I, that possesses my body, my feelings, my discriminations or discernments, my impulses or my karmic formations, and my consciousness. So there seems to be an I that exists independently of these five. And the emptiness of that is selflessness. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. Does that? That's kind of a. It can be a breeding ground for a lot of confusion, emptiness. We talk about emptiness and selflessness all the time, and so why their points 3 and 4 are different than each other is because of that exact reason. That the aggregates are empty of the I, and the I itself that possesses the aggregates is also empty. And that's what is meant by selflessness or dogme. Okay, so then the four seals. Now this is important. The four seals are what are, these are the hallmark, are the signs of Buddhist thinking. And so Buddhist thinking posits these four conditions. That this is these four conditions are characteristics, or seals are characteristics of samsara. That all compounded phenomena are impermanent. That's everything. There's nothing that's permanent. Well, what about the continuum? What about Buddha nature, the continuum of consciousness from life to life? Well, it's analogous to not stepping in the same river twice. It's called the Colorado, or it's called, that name sticks with it, but it's not the same river because it's always changing moment to moment. And so in a similar way, even Buddha nature itself is impermanent because it's transient, in that it changes from moment to moment. It's not static or stuck. And so, in any case, Buddha nature when it reaches fruition, is called enlightenment. And Maitreya Buddha says Buddha is permanent. But then he qualifies it, transcendent permanence, means that once it's attained, that's it. It's never unattained after that. And so, in Buddhist cosmology, when we talk about samsara and enlightenment, samsara is the one phenomenon that has no beginning but does have an end, and enlightenment is the one phenomenon in the continuum of a single being that has a beginning but has no end. So, anyway, so all compounded phenomena are impermanent. It means that anything that is made is reliant upon causes and conditions, is not frozen in time and space. And there's two types of there's two ways to realize impermanence. One is called, we recognize or realize gross impermanence, which is kind of obvious. Gross impermanence is, you know, we know someone for a long time and then they pass away. Then that's a gross impermanence. Or, you know, one day our house is here, and then like Nalanda's library. They had this big library at Nalanda, and now they don't. It burned up, you know. So, the gross impermanence. Profound Buddhist teaching. What happened to the library? The library, all the books. About impermanence. Okay. So the gross impermanence and subtle impermanence is that everything that's momentary or changing moment by moment. And this body's a great example. You know, we're sitting here. It's like I've actually heard it said, like, well, you know, sitting around, it's sort of like, well, what are you doing? It's like, well, you know, you don't look too busy. It's like, well, on an atomic level, I'm extremely busy. Things are changing. A lot's happening. You know. Interesting. I read in a book recently that, like, one atom, if we could blow an atom up to the size of St. Peter's Basilica, that the nucleus of the atom would be like one proton in the nucleus of the atom would be equivalent to a grain of sand. And that the electrons circling around the nucleus of that atom would be at the circumference of the periphery of St. Peter's Basilica. And that the rest of the atom is like empty, totally empty space. And I guess then we could get into each proton and neutron and so forth and realize that those two are also compounded phenomena. So, okay. The four seals of existence of all compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering. Contaminated phenomena. We've talked about that. All phenomena are empty and selfless. Okay. And the fourth of the seals, which we've already, these first three, the third one, empty and selfless, includes the first four qualities of the first of the four noble truths. The fourth one is nirvana is peace. Okay, now that's the seal of existence, which means the solution to suffering is found through realizing the emptiness of the self, the person, thereby giving up the grasping at the cause of creating karma out of delusion, attachment, and aversion. And that when this is given up through a complete turning about or inner transformation that is the result of realizing the true nature of phenomena deeply within the core of one's being, there's a complete transformation and the foundation for samsara is no longer there. That's why it's called the fourth seal is nirvana is peace. Is because it is definite cessation, and there are qualities of nirvana. For example, that nirvana is true cessation, that nirvana is peace or pacification, that nirvana is helpful and blissful, and that nirvana is definite emergence or definite deliverance, meaning that you don't come back into samsara after the attainment of nirvana. Things are never the same after that. That's the fourth seal. And we can think, we can understand why this is very important. Because if we try all of this and we invest all of this time and energy into finding, isolating within ourselves how we suffer and the cause for that suffering, and then we undo it through the force of listening to, meditating upon, and realizing the truth as is posited in the Four Noble Truths, well, what would be the point if it's just going to have to happen again? And so this fourth seal is very important in that the attainment of nirvana is definitive, in that the suffering and the cause of suffering has been uprooted forever. That the cause for suffering has been annihilated. And nirvana means, in fact, blown out or annihilated. Near, like, it's the same, like we say, no, near, the syllable, the sound, meaning negative. You know, nirvana means that, means that the fire of samsara has been extinguished or annihilated.
So is nirvana only experienced by Buddhas?
No, arhats. In fact, I mean, well, that's another workshop, or we can talk about the you know, it's important to learn more about the distinction or the qualities of an enlightened being, as opposed to those of a foe destroyer. And that formed actually that particular discussion was the catalyst for what we now call Hinayana and Mahayana, the evolution of those two approaches to to liberation. But that would be, it's related, but I think it would be a topic for another couple of evenings, a few evenings, 3 evenings or so. So then Nirvana's peace, those 4 seals. Okay, now true cessation of suffering. Okay. Cessation, peace, benefit, and bliss. Okay. Now, I think we're pretty clear about that. How Nirvana is the cessation of suffering, because it annihilates or uproots or extinguishes the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering is what?
Ignorance.
Ignorance, right? Hallucinating a mode of existence upon phenomena, particularly this body-mind composition, a me that has these particular likes and dislikes, and therefore I go forth into the universe with this agenda. And instead of creating the cause of happiness, I in fact create the cause for further and further enmeshment in delusion and suffering. And this is a delusion with regard to karma, because I think I'm creating the cause for happiness, but in fact I'm just compounding delusion. Okay. So, and then true paths. See, we might even be finished way ahead of schedule here. That'd be a trip, wouldn't it? It'd be the first whole evening is sort of like we didn't get past like the first, you know. We didn't actually. Okay. So we can actually jump right straight forward into the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths. And the reason that we can do that is because through that we will go back to cessation, peace, benefit, and bliss, definite and emergence. We'll also go cause, and then you know, the true paths, the 4 attributes of the true paths: knower, achiever, and definite elimination, or definite emergence. And then we'll talk about the 5 paths. And so each of the four truths of the Aryas has 4 characteristics. And so I'll enumerate them, and then when I go back to describing, you're going to say, yeah, but you've already told that ad nauseam. I told us that. Let's learn something new now. Okay. Suffering has these four attributes, and which is that we talked about already, impermanence. Things are impermanent. Contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering. That the aggregates are empty of the self, and that the self itself is selfless, or the self itself is empty. the I. Okay, and then the causes, delusion and karma. And delusion and karma have which is the cause of suffering, has also four attributes. That it's the definite cause, that it's the definite origin, that it's the definite condition, and it's the definite or strong producer. And then the cessation of true suffering, the third of the truths of the Aryas, is that it's the definite cessation. It does bring about the downfall of samsara. It brings about pacification, which means it pacifies the cause of samsara and brings peace, inner peace. The third quality is that it is helpful and blissful. It not only brings peace, but it brings great joy from release or ineffable happiness. And then the third is definite emergence, which means that samsara is no more in the continuum of that being. So well, I'll go back and speak a bit more about them. And then the four attributes of the path are: it's the true, it is the path. In that I'm going to talk more. About, I'm going to go back. So it's the path. Okay, it's awareness or knowing. It's achieving or attainment. And it's deliverance. Okay, so we talked already about the first four attributes of the four attributes of the first, the truth of suffering. Now that's what I'm thinking. We really might finish in time for there to be some discussion. Yeah. Okay. So, and then the second delusion and karma is the true cause. And the four characteristics is that it's the true cause because it relentlessly produces or constantly produces suffering. It's the true cause because delusion and karma are relentless or unremitting in producing suffering. Okay, it's the condition or it's the origin because it all the types of suffering come from it. So it's the cause of suffering in that it's continuously producing suffering, moment to moment. We talked about that before in the beginning. Something's not quite right, even when I'm happy, I'm not happy. Okay, so it's relentless in that it produces suffering. And all of the myriad appearances of suffering, all of the various sufferings are coming from delusion and karma. And so it's called the origin or the true origin because all sufferings come from delusion and karma. Okay, and then it's the condition because, and we talked about this, for example, the conditions of the completing karma, the throwing or propelling and completing karma. Okay, the conditions, which means the environment and the particular surroundings and situations that we continuously confront or have to deal with. All of those sufferings, the conditions of this existence is the outcome of delusion and karma. And it's the strong producer, which means, like we talked about this last night, the result similar to the cause. through the force of habit, it feeds upon itself and creates, through the force of familiarity and driven by delusion, creates again and again and again. Now it's like So in other words, we could say, well, what came first, really? You know, ignorance came first, or the suffering came first. First, before we suffered, we were ignorant. But it's that it really, in fact, makes no difference, or is academic. That's not a question that needs to be answered. Well, ignorance came first, or suffering came first, because they are interrelated with each other. And it's like, for example, in meditation, when we dismantle wrong view in meditation, we have a generic or a mental image. Generic image means that we know what prayer beads are. So when we don't see this, we can still have a mental image of this prayer beads, and it's there. So that when we actually see it, that mental image we infuse or put into this phenomenon. It's like we project right into this base of imputation our mental image. We have a mental image of a permanence, or a true or self-existing, the self of this. The mental image that we have of this is that it truly exists by itself. There's a mala, string and beads there, a set of prayer beads that we have a generic or a mental image of. This isn't my car. My car, we have a different mental image. You know, our front door to our house or whatever, we have a mental image based upon a perception of that thing. Now, what came first, the name or the mental image of it? Interesting. Well, okay, so the thing is this, that if I misapprehend this as self as truly existing, then the initial moment of perception, I see it dualistically, I see it as existing from its own side. In the next moment of consciousness, I grasp onto it as existing as it appears. Right? So it's called perceiving and holding. The phenomenon is called perceiving and holding. Now in secret mantra, if we're going to be studying secret mantra, in the completing stage of secret mantra, one channel is called the perceiving channel, and the other channel is called the holding channel. And the idea in central channel meditation is to bring the subtle wind that supports misapprehension and holding that misapprehension as being true, perceiving and holding, to bring them into the central channel and therefore pull the rug out from under dualistic view. That's the thinking of central channel meditation, when they call this the perceiving and holding channel. Okay, now, if I had not already grasped this as truly existing before, where did my deluded view come from? It's because I misapprehend it and then I grasp it as existing as it appears. That flavors the ensuing moment of consciousness. I'm already anticipating true existence. And so perceiving and holding is not, it's not possible really to separate them. But they're not exactly the same either. And so what we're talking about is making peace with a concept that is difficult to actually put into words, because it's a little bit beyond the realm of words' reach. That doesn't mean that we can't realize it and understand and all communicate about this. And so when we're talking about perceiving and holding. We can't say what comes first, the misapprehension or the holding. If we did not already anticipate true existence, it wouldn't appear that way. So these two things is kind of like, you can't tell where a circle starts. It's exactly like that. What we can do is intervene on that circle or break that circle through the force of dismantling the mechanism or the dynamics of ignorance. Ignorance that gives rise to delusion. Okay, so let's see, what were we talking about? We were talking about the second path, the second one. Delusion is the true delusion, and karma is the true cause. It's the true origin, because it brings about all of the sufferings. It's the strong producer. Yeah, that's where we were. It's the strong producer, because it compels us again and again to have that same deluded perception or mental wrong view. So I didn't have to turn this off. Excuse me. It's the strong producer, because once it happens, it enables us to do it again. In the same way that we're talking about the perceiver and the holder. Once it happens, it creates the cause for it to happen again and again and again. So that's why it's called the thorough, or the powerful, or the strong producer. Okay, then. okay, so then the fourth, the third, the nirvana is peace. The true cessation, true cessation, the reason, okay, that it's called the four truths of the Aryas. Now, when we look at the fourth one, true paths, the first is called path, or true path, because the direct experience, you know, of emptiness brings release. The second one is called knowing, or awareness. Now, what that awareness is, the second quality of the fourth truth, awareness, what that awareness is, that it is aware or knows what is suffering, and it also knows the cause of suffering. And this is the object of awareness only of an Arya being, or an object of experience only of an Arya being. We think, we know it about suffering. We understand suffering. But in fact, not true. If we really understood suffering deeply, we would understand that the true cause of suffering, in fact, is the ignorance that perceives the true existence of the self. Knowing that that is the object to be negated, knowing the object that is negated by wisdom, is in fact only the experience of an exalted being. in the same way that we talked about in the very beginning, we can't let go of something that we don't know what it is. If I don't know what suffering is, or I don't know what is the generic image or the mental image of true existence, if I don't know that, how can I let that go? If I don't know the object of negation, then how can I transcend it? It's not transcending, it's repressing. Or it's, in fact, a form of ignorance. I've stated this quite a few times that I can remember. Geshe Rapton, deceased, taught in Switzerland at a place called Dargeling, Tübken Dargeling, in Switzerland for a number of years. And he wrote this book, I think, Echoes of Voidness, where he talks about his own path to the realization of emptiness. And when I heard him teach also in person, and in Madison he did teach on emptiness for about a week. And he harped over and over on the importance of realizing the object to be negated. And he told us that he had to meditate on the object of negation for 2 years before, when he got clear about the object of negation, he immediately had intuitive realization of emptiness. And the object of negation is true existence. And so it was interesting to hear Geshe Rapton teach that you have to realize what true existence seemingly is in order to eradicate it. And so why would suffering be a truth of the Aryas? Because you don't have to be an exalted being to realize that conditioned existence is suffering. I mean, I suffer every day, you know. I suffer if I get sick. I suffer in traffic jams. I suffer when I feel criticized. I suffer when I don't feel validated, when my self-esteem takes a hit somehow. But all those are superficial levels of suffering. To understand true suffering, it requires the insight of an exalted being. And when they actually penetrate into what true suffering really is, then that becomes actually the agent for liberation, because we see the real mistake that's made. We perceive the actual mistake that is driving samsara, and by perceiving that, we know exactly the remedy. Oh yeah, in the same way that the emptiness of water in a mirage. If the illusion of water in a mirage is the object of ordinary beings, then the Arya is endowed with greater knowledge in that, oh no, it just looks like a lake. But it's not. I have no attachment for the water in that lake because there isn't any. And so if suffering, you know, was believing that the water is actually there, then the Arya being is the one who realizes that it's not at all what it appears. And that's why true suffering is only the object of the Arya being, because true suffering is in fact being out of harmony with absolute truth. That itself is suffering. So, and then that second aspect, awareness or knowing, is the reason why we can say that the first of the Four Noble Truths is called a truth for an Arya. Because true suffering is only perceived by an Arya, is only understood by an Arya. Okay, now achieving or attainment, this third, okay. So we all know where we are? in terms of the 16 attributes. We've done the four of the first noble truth. We've done the four of the second noble truth. We've done the four of the third noble truth. So now we're on the four of the fourth noble truth, true path. Okay, so we talked about it's a true path because the path of seeing delivers one to Aryahood and puts a cessation to samsara. It's called the knowing or awareness because it knows true suffering and true happiness. And it's called attainment because it achieves the cessation of suffering. And it's called it's called death and an emergence because one arrives at the plane or the path. It delivers one to the path of no more learning. Okay, so then these four noble truths then are realized through more paths, five paths. Okay, so these five paths, in essence, accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more learning. Okay, the first one, accumulation. And the path of accumulation, you would think, okay, if we would think, okay, accumulation is the first, and then preparation is the second, go, wait a minute. We prepare first. First we prepare, and then we accumulate. And that would seemingly be accurate, except for the fact that here it's not. It's not accurate, because in the path of accumulation, the emphasis is upon studying, listening to teachings, thinking about them. Is this true, or is this BS? Is the last, you know, several nights that we've put together, it's like all this about, like, is it in fact an accurate description of how I suffer, and the origins of my suffering, and the evolution of my suffering, and how my life looks and feels to me? Is it accurate or not? So learning about and contemplating the knowledge, the points, the aspects of the teaching, the aspects, the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, learning about them. And that's the path of accumulation. We're accumulating knowledge and skill. Now the second one, the path of preparation, why it's called the path of preparation is because that the person, the aspirant or the seeker, is preparing to enter the path of no more learning. So first we accumulate teachings. Okay, we learn about and study the teaching. Okay, the second path, the path of preparation, the emphasis begins to fall upon meditation. And so in the path of accumulation, the emphasis is more on studying and acquiring knowledge. And in the second path, the path of preparation, the emphasis is on learning meditation, how to focus, and how to meditate, on which eventually delivers one into the experience. The last moment on the path of preparation is called the peak experience, which means that finally, in a meditation session, we experience the emptiness of the self with such vivid clarity and power that it becomes a transformative experience. And so on the path of preparation, what the main thing that we cultivate is calm abiding, or shine, or in Sanskrit called shamatha. Shamatha. And shamatha vipassana are interdependent. They are practiced in tandem with each other. Now vipassana meditation, we hear a lot about it. Vipassana meditation. And vipassana meditation is like watching breathing. That is not vipassana meditation. I mean, I don't want to burst any bubbles, or I know, and I actually have met Goenkaji, for example, and various Vipassana teachers, the Indians, you know. And then also I know Jack Kornfield and John Kabat-Zinn. I've read their books and so forth. Now these are aspects of Vipassana meditation, but they are not Vipassana meditation. They are shamatha. And shamatha means concentration or focusing the mind upon one object. Vipassana means insight. Okay, and so when we're practicing what we call, what is called commonly Vipassana meditation, sweeping, you know, to go from the toes to the head and back, you know, developing heightened awareness of sensations, that in fact is shamatha meditation, which means focus or concentration or calm abiding. What is meant by calm abiding? Calm means to calm or pacify discursive thought through the force of concentration. Normally the mind is running helter and skelter, hither, thither, yon. So to calm that mind through the force of one-pointedness, that's why it's called shamatha, or peaceful abiding. It's in Tibetan it's called shine. She means peaceful and ne means to abide. Okay, so on the path of preparation, we cultivate meditation through the stages of calm abiding, which means learning how to put the mind on one object of meditation, and we leave it there, and a couple of seconds later, boop, it's off someplace else, and then we learn how to go, oh, you know, come on back, you know, it's like come back onto the object of meditation, and then you refocus mindfulness, and you use memory to kind of like remember the specifics of the meditation object, and mindfulness to remain upon it. And then you use like vigilance as a mental factor, that when you're off of the meditation object, vigilance goes up, you know, come on back. Or if you begin to sink into the object, it's not that the mind is like running away from the object, but it kind of goes to sleep or attains, it's called dullness. It fixes on the object, but then kind of goes into it and loses awareness and becomes unconscious. So that's called sinking. And so vigilance goes up, you're sinking, time to wake up and refocus mindfulness and memory, vigilance. You know. So this is a process. There's an art to meditation. That would be something else we could... So on the path of preparation, cultivating the art of meditation, learning about meditation and using meditation is what the main emphasis. Eventually, when calm abiding is realized, or perfect concentration is realized, that focus or that mind of concentration turned on to the emptiness of the aggregates, and that the possessor of the aggregates is also empty, then one, the meditator experiences one's own true nature with such vivid power and clarity that it's a breakthrough. And that's called the path of seeing. Meaning that one really understands that there's no, you know, we kind of feel like we're living almost in a haunted house. Not scary, but it's kind of like, hey, you know, there's nobody here. So then that direct insight into an experience in one-pointed meditation of the emptiness of the self, then we have now a really clear, like, generic image of the right experience. You know, first of all, in the path of accumulation, we cultivate the meditation object. And then through the path of preparation, we focus upon it. And then through the path of seeing, we experience that. And then going further and further into the experience is the path of meditation. And the path of meditation is divided into 9 different stages. There's the gross, where gross delusions are shed, and then gross middling delusions are shed, and then gross subtle delusions are shed, and then middling gross, and middling middle, and middling subtle, and then gross subtle, and or subtle gross, subtle middling, and subtle subtle, until finally then one attains the perfect photodestroyer state, or complete nirvana. Path of no more learning. Well, do you have a question?
Yeah, is that something happens like during samatha, does the insight into the emptiness of the self naturally occur from samatha, or it's focusing one pointedly on the emptiness of the aggregate?
And the emptiness of the self.
Is that then an analytical meditation where you hang out and think about it for a long time, or what is that exactly?
And that meditation is analytical in the path of accumulation, and that, as Geshe Rapkin said, we become very familiar with what is negated. But then shamatha itself is just concentration, and shamatha can be attained on any object.
Right.
And so shamatha in and of itself is not. Intrinsically, the realization of emptiness is not intrinsic to shamatha, but shamatha is required to realize emptiness non-conceptually. For emptiness to be realized with enough power and force that it becomes transformative, then concentration is the means by which that occurs. Peaceful abiding is the means by which that occurs, but simply attaining calm abiding is not does not intrinsically produce insight.
But
it's essential. Without shamatha, there's no vipassana. Without shamatha, there's no vipassana. But shamatha is not vipassana. Shamatha can be attained without vipassana. When the sweeping the body, the reason for that being done is that the meditator learns that the self is nowhere in the body, the self is nowhere in the feelings, the self is nowhere in the discernments, the self is nowhere in the karmic formations, the self is nowhere in the consciousness. And that other than these five aggregates, there's nothing left to be called self. You know, we say my body, my feelings, my cognition, or my discernments, karmic formations in my consciousness. And yet, if this I is not found in any of those, if those didn't exist, the I has nothing upon which to be labeled. And so the I itself is also empty. And so realizing that natural emptiness of the self with one-pointed meditation, it becomes transformative, or like a breakthrough experience.
During the practice last month, is that where you're concentrating on bodhisattvas and others in meditation? Can that be also like samatha?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Anything, any object of awareness can be a meditation object. Okay, then, so the path of seeing, then path of meditation, path of no more learning. Path of no more learning to the hearers and solitary realizers vehicles is arhatship or arhathood, and path of no more learning to the bodhisattva vehicle is enlightenment. And briefly, we can say that it's a fairly complex discussion, but in a concise way, we can say that the hearers are those that listen to the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, meditate upon the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, and realize through the force of one-pointedness the truth of the Four Noble Truths, and attain nirvana. Those are called hearers, because they listen to, meditate upon, and realize nirvana. And so their position is that when the person, the meditator, realizes the emptiness of the self in meditation, attains nirvana, that as long as they have this body, this is called nirvana with remainder. And the remainder is the body. Then when the body dies, they say it's like, well, it's kind of like the air inside of a vase mingling with the air outside of the vase. And so that the air in and out of the vase is the same, it's just that the vase is the remainder. So that when the vase breaks, then you attain nirvana without remainder. And so their position is that that is equal to the attainment of an enlightened being or a Buddha. And the Mahasanghika, the Mahayana adherents say, no, that's not true. That defeats the whole meaning of Buddha. That why would there be a founder of a path? Why would there be one who is endowed with the unlimited skillful means to demonstrate the path to enlightenment for our benefit, to turn the wheel of the Dharma three times, from which came the 84,000 articles of teaching? Now, what's the point if a Buddha that is a wheel turner is the same as a person who attains, or a seeker who attains nirvana? There's a discrepancy there. That the nirvana, the attainer of nirvana, or the arhat, remains in the samadhi of nirvana for a very, very long time, but eventually the awareness that infinite sentient beings are still suffering will cause that arhat to become, in essence, disillusioned with nirvana, and will inspire that arhat to attain enlightenment for the benefit, to be a benefit to all universal living beings. And that from the Mahayana perspective, this is not the same as the foe destroyer. The foe destroyer and the eighth level bodhisattva have the same degree of realization of the emptiness of the self. And yet the bodhisattva goes through the eighth, ninth, and tenth levels to acquire the attributes that are required or prerequisite to spontaneously manifesting for the benefit of sentient beings according to their karma. And that ability belongs to a Buddha, not to a foe destroyer. It's kind of a high sort of mystical debate. But how else do you explain why Shakyamuni Buddha would come and show the 12 deeds and manifest the path to enlightenment, and the path to the foe destroyer to attain nirvana? Whence comes that special skill that foe destroyers don't have? So to say that a Buddha and a foe destroyer is the same thing, the adherents of the Mahayana said that's wrong. They debated the point. Said, no, it's good. We're happy that one more sentient being has attained nirvana and is no longer, circling in samsara, and that's all very good, and the Buddhas all are happy. But to say that a foe destroyer and a Buddha is the same thing is like comparing a drop of water to an ocean. And so the main difference in the five paths from the Mahayana and the Hinayana perspective is that the path of no more learning to the Hinayana or the hearer is the attainment of nirvana. And in the Mahayana, the path of no more learning is not that. That, in fact, the path of no more learning to the Mahayana is the attainment of enlightenment, but that three bodhisattva levels before that, the realization of the bodhisattva equals that of the foe destroyer in terms of the emptiness of the self. Now, one thing you might find interesting is that in the 10 grounds of the Mahayana paths of the bodhisattva, the 10 paths of the ten grounds of pristine wisdom, first the joyous one, then the, I don't remember, but then the seven, first seven levels of the bodhisattva path is that time during which the bodhisattva progresses through the path of seeing. The initial breakthrough experience that delivers the bodhisattva on the path of the joyous one, the first of the bodhisattva paths, continuously practicing with an accurate realization of emptiness, continuing to meditate over and over and over and over until the foe-destroyer level is attained at the end of the seventh level, the seventh booming of the bodhisattva. Then comes the eighth, ninth, and tenth. And it's during that time that, from the Mahayana perspective, that's the path of meditation. So, according to the Mahayana, the path of meditation begins at the time that, for the foe destroyer, they attain the path of no more, the path of no more learning. The hearer's path of no more learning is equal to the bodhisattva's path of the attainment of the eighth level. And that the path of meditation only starts from the Mahayana perspective at the eighth level, eighth, ninth, and tenth. Now, something that's again very interesting, and this is where I'll stop, that when we talk about secret mantra positing the five paths, what's interesting in secret mantra is that in secret mantra it posits that, first of all, that delusion and ignorance is not the cause of suffering. Secret mantra says ignorance is not the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is that the very subtle winds that support the mind are not in the central channel, realizing emptiness. And so from the viewpoint of secret mantra, in order to attain enlightenment, we have to take the energy or the prana in the perceiving and holding channels and bring them into the central channel. And that by doing that, then that reveals the very subtle mind of clear light as a primary consciousness, and then that very subtle mind of clear light realizes emptiness. Okay, and so in secret mantra, their position is that the path of seeing is only one meditation session, and that when you attain the path of seeing in that one meditation session, it's not going through the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh bhumis. It's that the meditator goes into meditation, isolates the very subtle mind of clear light through the force of the simultaneous great bliss, and through the force of the simultaneous great bliss, revealing the very subtle mind of clear light as a primary consciousness, and then fusing or sealing, Mahamudra, sealing that very subtle mind with the wisdom that all phenomena are empty of true existence. Not only subjective phenomena, but also all phenomena. And so therefore that very subtle mind of clear light realizes emptiness in one meditation session. And then at the end of that meditation session you move to the next, to the level of meditation by breaking the meditation session that is the path of seeing. So the path of seeing meditation is one session, the meditator remains in that one session, the path of seeing, and then they enter the path of meditation by arising from that session. So it's interesting, but secret mantra also posits the five paths. When they attain, okay, so then in the meditation session in which the very subtle mind of clear light realizes the absolute true nature of phenomena without conceptual or mental image, then that as long as that meditation session lasts, the meditator is on the path of seeing. When they arise from the meditation, they attain the path of meditation and the impure illusory body. And so according to secret mantra, the first through the seventh bhumi bodhisattva that hasn't even attained the tantric path of seeing. And they go from like the path of preparation to the path of meditation in one meditation session. Whereas a normal sutrayana that takes like a couple of great countless eons. Whereas in secret mantra, why they call it very quick is because the person goes from the path of preparation to the path of meditation in one session. By isolating the very subtle mind of clear light as a primary consciousness, and then with that mind realizing emptiness, so that when the person arises from that, instead of ordinary appearance, they have the impure illusory body. And that then that's the path of meditation through the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis. And then it's called the attainment of meaning clear light, so that when the union of meaning clear light and the pure illusory body achieve yuga nada, or called the supreme union, so that when clear light and the illusory body become non-dual from each other, then that's the path of no more learning, or Buddhahood, or enlightenment, or whatever you want to call it. So that happens when the meaning clear light and the impure or the pure illusory body become indestructible. The way that it's talked about metaphorically is it's called the diamond lotus samadhi, that the meditator enters the diamond lotus samadhi and they never come out of it. They never arise from that samadhi. Doesn't matter if they're, you know, the way it's talked about in the Shakyamuni Buddha said, why is the Tathagata never depart from the Tathagata, even sleeping, walking, lying down, talking. And so it means that the diamond lotus samadhi is attained or realized, and then after that this doesn't matter. Meditation and non-meditation is no longer distinguishable. Okay. So the five paths, accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, no more learning. So we finished. So that's that concludes the discussion of the true paths. The fourth. So, are there any questions or discussion? There's one by His Holiness, and I think it's called the Four Truths, the Four Noble Truths, the Dalai Lama. And then there's one by Geshe Tsultan Gyatson, I think. Is that his name? Tsultan Gyatson? Geshe Tsultan Gyatson. It's called the Four Noble Truths. And I think Losang Gyatson. And it's quite good. Meditation on Emptiness. That's pretty. Yeah, it's the Jeffrey Hoffman's doctorate thesis. So it's pretty. Not light reading. Yeah, sit down and meditate. Just goes immediately into concentration. It's like the mind has become so supple through the path of preparation through practicing meditation over and over that one sits down to meditate and there's no longer like, oh, you know, how long am I going to keep the mind on the meditation object and up am I distracted, up am I sinking and like working with that. It's no longer like that. You sit down and go whoop right on the meditation object immediately. And if they have a correct meditation object in emptiness, they immediately sit down and go immediately into meditation on emptiness. And that becomes transformative. What was that?
At which point of the Bodhisattva Lama Sutrayana path does it enter into the tantric practice?
At any time. Whenever they meet that particular lineage. But it doesn't, you know, the thing is that the sutrayana, this is a good question, because
the quality of the, at the point of arriving at direct perception emptiness, the quality of that perception of a bodhisattva on the sutrayana path versus a bodhisattva on the tantric path. One is perceiving with the primary consciousness with a clear light, one is not. Am I?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there's a difference. So yes. Do you have to go through that? So at which point along the ten bhumi do they get into that?
At any time. Or in fact, a bodhisattva practicing tantra doesn't ever necessarily have to practice the or realize the bhumis of the sutrayana path.
Oh. So the ten bhumis are you referring
to the sutra path. And this is what gives rise to the debate, really, that the tantra constitutes its own path.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. This is very important, because the sutra, the paramitayana, is called the causal vehicle, and the tantra, or secret mantra, is called the resultant vehicle. And so whenever we hear three vehicles, and we're going to hear that a lot, and also some Tibetan teachers will say the three vehicles refers to the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Tantrayana, and that's not true. That's not right. And the reason that it's not right is that the goal of the Paramitayana is the attainment of enlightenment and Buddhahood. The goal of the Tantrayana, or secret mantra, is enlightenment or Buddhahood. So the goals are the same. Now, the three vehicles then is the hearer's vehicle that we talked about. The other one is called the Pratyaka Buddha, or the self-realizer. And then the third one is the Bodhisattva vehicle. Okay, now the Bodhisattva vehicle, why there's only one Bodhisattva vehicle, is determined because of one goal. They both are attaining, questing for enlightenment. Okay, and the distinction between the hearer and the self-conqueror vehicles is that the hearer listens to the Four Noble Truths, meditates upon them, and realizes them. The self-realizer, the self-conqueror, through the force of imprints and karma created in a previous existence, through the force of their own isolation and solitude, discover through the force of ripening imprints that they've already created in previous existences that the cause of suffering is delusion, and giving that up is in fact the path to peace. And so they don't necessarily need to hear the explanation of the Four Noble Truths by a Buddhist practitioner. They don't hear it, so they're not hearer's vehicle, but they still attain nirvana through the force of their merit created in previous existences. This is actually one reason that I admire very much the Buddhist path, is it doesn't posit you have to hear this Buddhist teaching in order to attain liberation. The liberation that is experienced by the solitary realizer or the self-conqueror is still giving up grasping at true existence. It's just that that person arrives at that conclusion or experience through the force of karmas created in a previous existence. And so the three vehicles are the hearer's vehicle, the self-conqueror's vehicle, and the bodhisattva vehicle. Now, the causal vehicle of the bodhisattva vehicle is the sutrayana, or the paramitayana. That means realizing that we have to go not only beyond samsara, but we have to go beyond nirvana. And that the way to do that is for the benefit of all universal living beings. And so the foundation for Mahayana thinking is loving kindness and compassion and concern for the welfare of all living beings everywhere. And so, therefore, that's the cause. Now, in order to attain enlightenment quickly, that's the result. That's why the Tantra is practiced, in order to bring about the experience of enlightenment quickly within oneself. And the reason to do that is that time is running and sentient beings are suffering. And so one adopts the extraordinary transmutational psychology of Tantra in order to bring about enlightenment quickly. But without the Sutrayana premise, there's nothing to realize. What enlightenment is there to realize without understanding that Buddhahood is attained for the benefit of all universal living beings, and that the reason for Buddha to exist is to demonstrate to sentient beings where their Buddha nature is within them and how to cause that to awaken. That's the purpose of an enlightened being, is to awaken sentient beings to their own Buddha nature. Not to attain enlightenment for them, but to show them where, how they will attain enlightenment themselves, or emulate enlightenment. So it doesn't mean that we practice all of the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more learning of the Sutrayana path first, and then practice Tantra. Once the foundation of the three principles, disillusionment with samsara, the will to attain enlightenment for all the benefit of all living beings everywhere, and the right view of emptiness is conceptually or intellectually integrated, that's the foundation upon which one can practice Tantra and doesn't need to practice the Sutrayana in a meticulous step-by-step fashion that the Paramitayana posits or asserts. That takes three great countless eons or a long, long time.
You talk about the 8 months, 10th day, where the Bodhisattva cultivates the ability to emanate spontaneously from the karma being. I mean, whether that's got to do with this tantric path of seeing, where you also have an illusory body arising, and is there a connection with that?
Well, during the time that the Sutrayana would posit that the Bodhisattva is moving through the nine levels of the path of meditation, now in the eighth bhumi it's the gross-gross, gross-middle, and gross-subtle. On the ninth bhumi it's the middle-gross, the middle-middle, and the middle-subtle. And on the tenth bhumi it's the subtle-gross, the subtle-middling, and the subtle-subtle. Those are the nine. Through those, and eventually the attainment of the Vajra Lotus Samadhi, upon which the person attains enlightenment. The secret mantra doesn't posit that the path of meditation takes place along those three bhumis. The path of secret mantra posits that this is when the impure illusory body and the example clear light become the meaning clear light in the pure illusory body. So they don't delineate it with the ten bhumis. They delineate it to the example clear light and the meaning clear light and the impure illusory body and the pure illusory body.
So at which point does the Bodhisattva practicing primarily with the sutra math, develop the illusory body?
They don't unless they practice secret mantra.
Yeah.
See, according to secret mantra, you don't attain enlightenment without secret mantra.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out, where it comes in for someone who's reached the seventh bhumi, for example.
They still, according to Tantra, you still have to practice Tantra.
Mm-hmm.
That without secret mantra, there's no way to attain enlightenment. Now that doesn't mean secret mantra in this particular form that we know. The essence of secret mantra is that the very subtle mind of clear light realizes the absolute true nature of all phenomena. And that the way to bring that about is through secret mantra. So there's kind of a disagreement between the adherents of secret mantra and the Paramitayana. According to the secret mantra, the Paramitayana is the preparation to practice secret mantra, but the secret mantra is the vehicle to enlightenment.
I have to be saying kind of like that, but sometimes you feel bad also. You are experiencing sometimes. And for me, that's very, very nice to hear.
Is it? I'm glad.
Okay. I know you have studied a lot. And I just very new to all of this.
Right.
And it is very sad for me to see that all human beings, we are very little things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think everybody has the advantage that you have to know all of this stuff. It is possible to reach enlightenment without knowing all that you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a few simple things. Yeah. That suffering is, conditioned existence is suffering. The cause of conditioned existence or suffering existence is ignorance. That when there's no more ignorance, there's a cessation of conditioned existence or suffering. And that the way to realize or to put an end to ignorance is through meditating upon a correct realization of true nature. That's all, in essence, that's it. That's the whole Four Noble Truths is right there in that. So all these different, you know, outlines and aspects of this and characteristics of that, you know, they're ways of helping get a clearer and clearer understanding. But when it comes right down to it, it's extremely simple. Anything more? I enjoyed myself a lot, and thank you very much. Thank you. So, dedicate the merits, and then meet again sometime soon, I hope. Oh, and thank you. I'm very glad you could make it. Gevadi nyo donda lama sangye do gyane dawati Shabbat Shalom.